Mr. Barnett, Reel 5. We were talking about the conditions and you being under fire on this hill above Salerno. What were living conditions like during this period of bombardment? How did you actually spend the time and what conditions were you under?
Well, I remember the name of this hill, which we call Hospital Hill because of the seminary we were at. And the hospital itself was agreed as a neutral zone, so we were careful not to go within its walls. But the weather, of course it was September, the weather was hot. We were in cotton uniforms, and because of the heat we were continuously thirsty. So supplies of water as well as food were pretty vital.
How were they brought up? Both.
Well, I find it very difficult to remember. They were brought up, of course, from battalion headquarters by other people other than in the rifle companies. Water came in jerry cans, 4-gallon cans, which we immediately, as soon as we got it, divided as well as we could between the men into their water bottles, which...
So you didn't keep a central store?
Oh no, there was no supply available. There were no buildings that had running water anywhere in the battlefield that we found. So that we were entirely dependent on water coming up the hill in cans. And because of the heat, we needed quite a lot of it, because I remember on one occasion being so thirsty that I attempted to squeeze some grapes in my beekeeper's net, you know, to drink the juice, which was surprisingly unsatisfying as a drink, I remember thinking. But supplies came up from below, but the general... perhaps if I describe what the general picture of a battlefield is on hilly country, then there was a set pattern of we were defending Hospital Hill. In retrospect, I realised that that's what we did during the battle was to sit on Hospital Hill and deny to the enemy. We didn't know it at the time or what was going to happen, of course, and it was attacked really remotely by shell fire and mortar fire. Long range machine guns at the time, but not by direct attack. So we didn't see Germans for a long time. And Hospital Hill was quite high and finished up with a very sharp pinnacle, which was a very good OP, and we had an artillery man up there in the end, of course, and during the week we slowly moved our way up this hill from position to position. Now, the idea is on a hill that taking an infantry platoon has three sections. So during daylight, you want to keep a few men, perhaps a section, perhaps less than a section, certainly not more, on the forward slope of the hill, where they can observe any impending attack. The other two sections stay on the rear slope of the hill, out of line of fire, direct fire, but not shell fire, of course, but out of vision anywhere. At night, the reverse happens. In fact, the whole three sections move onto the forward slope because you can't be seen because it's dark, but you do want to have your troops ready for a night attack, which is when attacks usually occur, mostly in the evening and at dawn.
And the positions you occupied had already been dug by the time you got there?
Yes, we always seem to have positions. I suppose the hill was fairly dotted with slit trenches.
And what was the average slit trench size and
depth? Well, it varied, but they held at the most three people. So that would be about 6 foot long, as deep as you could get it.
Which was on that hill.
Which varied according to the ground, of course. It was very rocky, as a lot of them were. You couldn't get very deep anywhere. And a couple of feet wide, like a grave. I usually occupied one on my own. I was in my own, in a small trench on my own, with others adjacent, of course. So that's the general positioning of the troops in every location.
And how did you go about movement? You had no communication trenches, or so?
Oh, no, no. The only way to move was when you thought there was a low in the fire. And I say at the outset that the artillery and mortar fire was continuous, night and day, for the week. I only slept once during that week.
So when you moved, it would be on the run then?
Yes, you'd either move on your stomach. I did a lot of see, one of my jobs is to go keep going round, visiting the platoon's trenches and the men in the forward positions and in the rear positions in the daylight and at night time as well. And I usually moved on the stomach.
And that was better than the run then?
Oh yes, because when you run you can be seen. You see, the hill was covered with low scrub on most of its slopes. There were some trees in gullies and vineyards on terraces on the south facing slope. So cover wasn't terribly good. It was very dry, of course, and fairly leafless, as the Mediterranean hills are. And so you moved when you had to move, when fire was taking place, mostly flat on your stomach, because you were safer on the ground, of course. So much so that I discovered that my tunic was as if slashed with razor blades from neck to the bottom. It was moving so fast on you get very good at it, like lizards, you know, you can squirm across the ground like snakes when you've been shot at. It's wonderful.
So presumably the front during the day, the front section would just be keeping their heads down in their slit trenches.
Yes.
But that's all, and the back two presumably as well.
That's right.
So not much for them to do.
No, not much for them to do except duck. And we did a lot of that. And it was, of course, absolutely terrifying, because the mortar fire was remarkably accurate. There's an interesting thing that happens too, particularly with artillery fire. When you can hear shells coming, you see. Bigger shells make slower noises than lower pitches and smaller shells. But all of them, after quite a short time of 2 or 3 days in shell fire, you can tell which ones are coming your way. And newcomers to the replacements coming up to join the platoon become a little bit laughed at a bit when they duck for every shell, when the rest of you, of course, know that it isn't for you.
Do you know what it was about?
And I've never been able to describe what it is, how you can tell the difference, but you can.
It's an instinctive level, then.
Yes, it's something in the noise that tells you whether it's coming. Yeah, I don't mean if it's coming. You can't tell if it's going to be 10 or 20 feet away, but it isn't on your position. It's far enough away not to duck. You can tell when they're coming. I can't tell you why.
So, getting back to perhaps the rations, what were you getting to eat while you were...
Well, the rations, that's very interesting, really, because we had compo rations, which you would have heard of, probably. So that's a box of, a wooden box of a day's rations for 7 men in each box. And they were lettered from A to G, I think, each letter denoting a different menu. Some were favourites and some weren't. And the food in them was very good quality. It included not only the three meals, but grams of tea sugar and milk all in one mix. Powdered milk, powdered tea and sugar. So you just throw it into boiling water to make a brew. Tinned plum pudding, which was so good that you could eat it cold with great relish. Tinned bacon. Sausages, of course, and ham. And toilet paper to last the day. A tin of 50 cigarettes, which remained with every day. Every man had a ration of 7 cigarettes. Hard-boiled sweets. And, of course, a tin of biscuits, hard biscuits, which were the bread, as you might call it, of the ration. And the biscuit tin made a very good tea boiler. And the wood from the packing case made a fire. But, of course, you couldn't really get to lighting fires. And I don't think, I can't recall having much tea. Except one day when we, for some reason, about the middle of the week, there was a lull in the firing in the afternoon, and the company commander, George Joby, came round to visit me. And we each lay on the ground alongside the slip trench with 2 hours each to sleep. I watched while he slept, and then he slept. He watched for 2 hours, and then I watched for 2 hours, and the other one had it. And that was the only sleep I had, really, during the week. And then,
so these compo rations, that there was enough for you to eat?
Oh, there was enough.
You weren't hungry?
No, but oddly enough, after the war, I used to have nightmares, as most people do, but it wasn't about the shelling or anything, it was about distributing the rations.
What was it?
Well, it's a terrible mathematical conundrum when you work with that. You see, you get, for example, a tin of butter. In the hot weather, it used to be soft. Well, how do you get butter from a tin which supplies 7 men to your men on the ground under fire? When it doesn't come in a little tin that you can just hand out to the man, it's in a half malt and in a big tin. Do you spoon it into their mess tins, like serving it out, you know, on the shelf or in broad daylight, where you don't want to be seen or what? That is that sort of conundrum of mathematics. If the American rations, you see, were rather boring, but came in little tins with the biscuits in the top and perhaps spam in the bottom for one man. That was easy, you could throw them to them. Well, you couldn't divide it. It was all right if you could bring 7 men to sit round in a little teapot and have a picnic. But they weren't even packed for an infantry section. If they come in 9 men to a box, you could have given the box to the section leader. But you see, you had a platoon headquarters and 3 sections, that's 4 units, fairly equal, not quite, and 3 boxes of rations. No, 4 boxes of rations. But it didn't work out 1 box per unit. So you had 9 men, you couldn't get 9 men, 7 men's rations, you see. So that was the problem of getting unpacking and distributing these odd rations. There might be 2 tins of bacon to 7 men, you see, 3.5 men to a tin. I mean, how do you work that out in the battlefield? It's not easy.
And that was part of your job?
And I did it, yes, because...
Not the sergeant?
No.
Did you get any other kind of rations coming up, or was it just the compo and the water?
No, we didn't get any cook food. Sometimes they used to, in other places, I believe, they used to bring up dixies of stew and that sort of thing, but we didn't have anything like it. We just had compo rations, which were very good, except for the distribution.
Now, what about the... You know, were the men able to keep clean, or was that just completely out of the window?
No. I shaved once during the week, and regretted it afterwards because I didn't have enough to drink. I used, you know, mother water to shave in and wished I hadn't.
Well, the men weren't expected to shave then if you weren't?
There was no water for washing at all. And of course, you never took your helmet off or your boots or anything like that.
What about latrines? How did the men?
Well, we used to do it outside the trench, of course. One amusing incident was when the adjutant was visiting. And he was taken short during his visit and went behind a bush just near to my trench, whereupon a shell came over, and when I looked over the top of the trench after it had burst, this bush was in a cloud of dust, and thought, my God, the adjutant's had it. But he emerged pulling up his trousers, visibly shaken. So
it was fairly insanitary by the end of the week, I presume.
Didn't know.
Or did people bury?
Oh no, I think the shells distributed it.
What I mean, you said you only slept this once when the company commander came up, but how did fatigue affect you? Because that's an unnatural length of time.
Yes, I think it describes a state of fitness we must have been in. We were very, very fit, at the right age to be fit and fit. And we survived, but it was afterwards that the reaction is interesting. I think after the battle was over, when you were able to relax, that we'll come to later.
So during the actual week, the fatigue doesn't seem to have been that much of a problem to
you? Well, you feel tired at times. If there's any sort of quietness for a bit, the exhaustion begins to appear, but it's too exciting to be worried about fatigue, really.
So it wasn't affecting your judgment then?
Oh, I guess it was, yes, but
you weren't aware of it?
No, I think you lived by instinct rather than judgment. I think under those circumstances, you were just either terribly frightened or the adrenaline was pumping.
As a platoon commander, you had the job of visiting your sections,
yes.
Checking. What were you checking for when you visit? You know, when you've told how you crawled between them, but
yes.
What exactly were you doing?
It was the only way of knowing what was going on, whether they'd seen anything, were there any signs of attack, or were they all right, any casualties, and so on. We were talking about casualties earlier, and I can't recall any. Except the ones I actually witnessed, and whether we didn't have any, I suppose is possible, but seems unlikely in my platoon, or whether they were reported to me and the men had already either walking wounded had gone down to the RFP without me seeing, which is more than likely. I can't recall, but perhaps we didn't have any. I can't recall a number of casualties in the platoon.
With the positions they'd got, would you expect them to have a sentry rota, and not a formal rota, but were they left to organise themselves as defence, or would you actually be along to check that the sentry was on duty, that sort of thing?
No, there was no single people on duty. Everybody was alert all the time. There was virtually no relaxation.
So you went round to check for those reasons. You had to distribute the rations,
yeah.
Which I presume you'd partially do while you were checking.
I'd do that once a day, just in the dark, preferably. We would probably distribute them in the dark. I'm finding it difficult to remember now, oddly enough, and it worries me that I can't remember how I did it. And when I recaptured the problem, I can't imagine how I solved it. It's a little bit disturbing in the opposite direction now. But I know it worries me tremendously.
So that was two of your duties. What other duties did you have as a platoon commander during that period,
No others, really. It's a matter of surviving.
How did you report to your company commander, to battalion? You know, how was communication?
By mouth. Or runner. But there was no wireless communication. We did have issued what we called 38 sets, which were small. There were two kinds of sets in the infantry, 38 and 18 sets. 38 sets were the small ones, which were four platoons to report to the company commanders. 18 sets were the things that companies had, which were a bigger set altogether on a backpack with a signaller. And you could actually get the BBC on those, which was interesting because that's the way we got to know what was going on in on the battlefield. But the small ones, the 38 sets, were virtually useless.
Why was that?
They just weren't good enough to, they weren't reliable enough. I don't ever remember using them.
Would there be a signaller with the 38 set or a half signaller? You know, would one man run it or?
Not with the 38 set, no, but only the company runner or the batman.
Would you have to report regularly to your company commander?
No.
Just if something happened?
Yes, or he would come to me.
How often would he? Would he be doing the equivalent of what you were doing then? He'd visit. You.
That's right, and as I've said, senior officers like the adjutant and the CO, we were doing the same.
So you did see the higher echelons of the battalion coming round?
Yeah, the CO I only recall once, and the adjutant once, but George, they come to command, of course, more frequently.
Now, what about the role of your NCOs? You know, how did the workload spread of command in your platoon with them? Well, I mean, what was your job and what was their job?
Each section was led by a corporal. He had a lance corporal. And they ran their sections. They placed them in the trenches that were in the positions allocated to them, or above the trenches.
And you'd allocate the positions?
I allocated the position to the sections, both day and night.
So they sort of took it on below you. What did you have a sergeant?
Yes.
What was his job?
Well, his job was my second in command, virtually. So he assisted me when we'd do things like discipline the rations between us. You know, we'd organise it between us.
Would he do a check? Would he do a patrol?
Oh,
not
yes.
He'd check that.
He would go as well, yeah.
Instead of you or with you?
No, instead of. We take it in turns, sir.
And so did he have any... I mean, he was your second. Was there anything that you did that he didn't and anything that he did that you didn't, if you see what I mean?
No, not really. No. It was a cooperative effort.
Do you think you had a special job to lead as an officer? You know, I mean,
yeah.
An inspirational part, did...
Well, yes, undoubtedly. I felt that I had to I had to be, how shall I put it, in the lead, in front. If there was an attack, I had to lead it, not from behind, of course. And if there was shelling, which we had to move through, I would go first. I felt it was my job.
Did you feel that you had to show sort of more courage under shell fire than perhaps other ranks?
That was accepted as the job.
And you were able to do that?
Yes, I think I was. Certainly, I think that explains the high casualty rate amongst junior officers, really. Every instinct you have under those circumstances, as I've said before, is to either hide in your hole and not come out of it, even to look, or more than ever, to run away. That's what any sensible person would do if circumstances weren't making him stay there out of pride or whatever. certainly not bravery, but it's your duty to your comrades, as you might put it, it's an overused word, not to desert, really.
So
that when all instincts are, unless someone tells you to get out of your hole and go somewhere, you won't go. I mean, I didn't go anywhere unless somebody told me to go. And likewise, I had to, therefore, show the way to my juniors and get up and go and tell them to go with, come with me.
You mentioned last time that when Preston, was it, that the colonel came,
yeah,
he was stood up and you were worried about him drawing attention to your position. But was he then almost giving the example to you as you gave the example to the men? I mean,
of calmness, yes, on the fire. Yes, of course, he was giving the same example. But the other instinct, you see, is to hide in your hole or hide behind a bush or whatever and not let the enemy know you're there. You don't want to be seen and make your presence familiar to them. So anyone who does wave a flag or something isn't very popular.
So in a sense, you felt that he was being fooled, whilst giving a calm display of a colonel under fire, he was also being slightly foolish.
Well, no. He was a better soldier than I was and a more experienced one. But one felt that I didn't want my position advertised to the enemy.
How did your platoon respond? I mean, you were under fire for a week, very little sleep. Did the men respond well?
Oh, they did, yes. I had no fault to find with them. I had no men who broke down or run away. Yes, they were very good.
I realise you might not have done, but did you hear any rumours of the mutiny amongst some of the troops from 151 Brigade who were sent to 16 Battalion?
No. Whether we got any men from them as replacements or not, I don't know. I don't think we were getting oddly enough many casualties. I mean, Gip Futter was wounded, I know, and my officers were wounded, I heard of, you know, that someone would say, oh, what's his name? Not a blighted one or something. And apart from anything else, if you heard somebody had walked off with a wound, it was a case for congratulation. I mean, they were the lucky ones. You know, you thought they were ended. I mean, the great thing to get was a walking wounded.
Did you really want that, though? I mean, would you?
All of us did, yes.
And how far were you prepared to go with the wound? I know you can't choose, but I mean, was this the flesh wound you were looking for? Or?
Didn't matter if it got you out of it. I mean, some people try to get malaria if they could by letting the mosquitoes bite them, but in fact, as you perhaps read Dr. John's report, even during the battle, there were more casualties for medical reasons than.
But there were no self-inflicted wounds.
Oh, yes, there were. My batman, not while he was, while I was with the battalion, but I heard later on he shot himself in the foot. Not, you know, after I'd left.
Was that common?
It was because of me, but.
Was that common?
No, it wasn't common, but it happened.
Your batman, was he, when you were in action, would you bat, no, he, the officer's servant, would he do things for you during the battle, or was it the race?
No, dug by, you know, digging trenches or whatever.